Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. If, like me, you indulged in that little tart which was full of chocolatey goodness at lunch, then this is your opportunity to exert all your mental energy and wear it off. This session is on stress and scenario testing. My name is Brylan Cummings, and I'm the chair for this session. Your speakers today are Gerard Callahan and Georgina Hemmings. Gerard is the director in the Actuarial Insurance and Superannuation Practice of KPMG Australia. He's a qualified actuary with over 15 years' experience specialising in life insurance and wealth management. He's recently worked with a number of Australian life insurers on reviews and development of their ICAP, notably in the stress and scenario testing area. He's also worked with a number of KPMG clients in the UK, implementing the ability to perform stress and scenario testing as part of Solvency II. Georgina is a manager within KPMG's Actuarial Insurance Risk and Superannuation Practice based in Melbourne. She's a qualified actuary in the CIRA with over 10 years of experience in the life insurance sector in both Australia and the UK. She's recently worked on developing a Pillar 2 framework for an overseas regulator. Please join with me in welcoming them to the stage.
Thank you, Brylan, for the introduction. Okay, so since the introduction of LAGIC and ICAP in 2013, KPMG has undertaken regular benchmarking surveys to gain insight into how the industry has evolved and sophistication of practices. This year, we elected to focus on stress and scenario testing for a couple of reasons. Firstly, off the back of APRA's recent industry-wide stress test and the results from that, which were presented at the end of last year, but more importantly, because of increased client focus in this area. We undertook a global survey, and 29 companies across Australia, Canada and New Zealand responded. We hope that some of you who responded are in the audience today, and I think we do have a couple of people. So thank you very much for taking the time to participate. A response rate of 29 companies is a really fantastic outcome, and we're very delighted, and we hope that you get as much enjoyment out of this presentation as we have. So why stress and scenario testing? I've included a couple of quotes here from Jeff Summerhayes' presentation on insights into APRA's 2015 industry-wide stress test. At the time of conducting this test, APRA met with insurers and had some concerns about resourcing and basic infrastructure processes and procedures and readiness to perform the test. During his presentation, Jeff Summerhayes said that the industry has, in the past, not necessarily viewed stress testing as part of its DNA. Now, we thought that this was a really interesting comment. If you look at, for instance, the banking industry, where ICAP has been around for a lot longer than in the life insurance industry, when we spoke to some of our banking colleagues about this, they said that for medium to large banks, they would view it as part of their DNA. So I guess this raises the question, is this good enough for the life insurance industry? Could we be getting more value out of stress scenario testing? Could we think differently? These are the types of questions that we asked ourselves when we were putting together our survey. We wanted to understand what value companies were getting from the process. We wanted to understand how companies were using stress and scenario testing, and we wanted to know what you were thinking about for the future. A little bit of a lesson or background into the regulatory environment. Risk-based capital requirements and Pillar 2 requirements have formalised the need to perform stress and scenario testing. Obviously, an ORSA or ICAP is an insurer's own view of its capital position, taking into consideration its own risk profile. So stress and scenario testing is understandably an integral part of that. It is a developing area, so we all know that ICAP has been around since 2013 in Australia. ORSA requirements in Canada were formalised in 2014. However, where Canada differs is that there has been a formal requirement to perform stress testing that has been in place since 2009. New Zealand's a little bit different in that there's no formal ORSL or ICAT requirement. However, there are some expectations around stress testing in relation to liquidity risks and implicit and contingency planning that have been in place since 2012. So the message here is this is a developing and evolving area. If we look at regulations, regulators tend to say that the insurer should perform stress testing and scenario testing. In some jurisdictions, reverse stress testing is also explicitly mentioned. Regulators don't tend to prescribe how to go about that. Our observations of market practice is that implementation and methodology varies widely, and perhaps this is a reason why insurers are interested in knowing a little bit more about what their peers are up to. A little bit of information about the 29 companies that responded. 13 Australian companies, 10 Canadian, and 6 from New Zealand. The bulk were direct insurers, only a couple of reinsurers participated, and nearly 3/4 were classified as large based on revenue in excess of $1 billion AUD. Interaction between country and size, 90% or 9 in 10 Canadian companies were classified as large. 50% of New Zealand companies were classified as large, and 69 or 9 of 13 Australian companies were classified as large. The topics covered in our survey. For those who participated, you already know this, but we covered 43 questions in our survey, considering a broad range of areas. We obviously don't have enough time to talk through all of them today as much as we would love to, but if anybody is interested, come and see me during the break or over dinner tonight, because I have 43 icebreakers that I want to try out. what we're doing today is we're focusing on the areas that we've highlighted in blue. For survey participants, we'll be getting in touch with you shortly with your individualised response. So don't panic. If you don't catch me tonight, you will get some bit of information on each of the questions that you responded to. So just getting back to this comment about DNA. For something to be part of a company's DNA, there must be areas of the business that are getting value out of it. I think that's probably a fairly reasonable assumption. So one of the questions that we ask companies is, how is stress and scenario testing valued by different stakeholders? Now, I know that this is a very busy slide, so I'll just talk you through it briefly. So down the left-hand side, we've got the numbers 1 to 13. This represents each of the companies in Australia. Across the top, we've got the different stakeholders: board, C-suite, actuarial, risk management, and finance and reporting. And then down the bottom, we've got the key for the colours with using our extended traffic light system. What we're looking for here is greens and blues. Green represents that the stakeholder views stress and scenario testing as fundamental to their role. Blue means that the stakeholder view stress and scenario testing as highly valuable. So if we focus on the columns for actuarial and risk management, we can see that these are the star performers here. We've got lots of blue and a few greens for both of these areas of the business. So these are the areas that are deriving the most value out of stress and scenario testing in Australia. If we then move across to look at the columns for the board and the C-suite, it's reassuring to see that many boards are gaining value from stress and scenario testing. There are a few that view it as highly valuable, but there are no boards that view it as, or C-suites that view it as fundamental to their role. If we move across to the other side, to finance and reporting, these areas of the business are the ones that are getting comparatively least value out of stress and scenario testing, as evidenced by the orange, or them viewing it as somewhat valuable. A possible reason for this is these areas may tend to be more focused on a retrospective position, considering financial position and performance, whereas stress and scenario testing is a prospective tool. Maybe a way to get buy-in here is through the sensitivities in the notes to the accounts. So that's the colour scheme for Australia. If we now move across to Canada, the key difference here, so same thing again, we've got our 10 companies down the side, stakeholders across the top. So the key difference here is the board and the C-suite, where we saw a lot of yellow or a view of that stress and scenario testing is valuable. For Canada, we can see that the boards are viewing it as highly valuable, and also that there's two boards and C-suites that view it as fundamental to their role. So why would Canadian insurers be getting more value from stress and scenario testing than Australian insurers? A possible reason for this is that Canada has been doing this longer, so maybe with the passage of time comes value. Canada has had a formal requirement, as I mentioned, since 2009, whereas ICAP has been in place here since 2013. Also, 90% of Canadian companies are large, so maybe we have a correlation between size and the value that the board derives from stress and scenario testing. Another observation that we made is, and this doesn't just apply to Canada, this is across the board for the companies that we surveyed. Boards of shareholder-owned companies tend to be getting more value out of stress and scenario testing than boards supported by a large overseas parent. We'd be really interested as well if during our Q&A, if you have any suggestions that would explain some of these differences. Now moving briefly to New Zealand, we can see that there are 50% of New Zealand boards view stress and scenario testing as highly valuable. And we've also got one company there that views it as fundamental to their role. And this is quite interesting given that New Zealand doesn't have a formal ORSA or ICAP requirement. Okay, so now for the remainder of our presentation, we've split the results into two groups based on the value the board places on stress and scenario testing. So where they view it as fundamental to the role or highly valuable, we've classified these companies as the highly valuable group, with the other companies being classified as less valuable. You can see that the group, the 29 companies are roughly split, and as I've mentioned in the previous slides, we've got a greater proportion of Canadian companies that are falling into the highly valuable group and a greater proportion of Australian companies that are falling into the less valuable group. So now on to the purpose of stress and scenario testing. The next few slides are going to follow a similar format, so I'll just quickly talk you through what you're looking at here. So we've got our companies whose board views stress and scenario testing as fundamental or highly valuable on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side we've got our companies in the less valuable group. Responses to the questions are listed on the left-hand on the vertical axis, and on the horizontal axis we have number of companies that responded to the question or responded with that in that area. For this question, we asked companies to rate the top four areas where they are using stress and scenario testing for decision making. If we look at our highly valuable our companies in the highly valuable group, they seem to be clear in their purpose. They use stress and scenario testing for setting buffer capital, risk appetite, and risk monitoring. If we compare this to the companies in the less valuable group, they seem to be a bit more variable in their purpose, and there also seems to be more of a regulatory focus. This is actually driven by Australian companies 12 out of the 13 Australian companies that responded answered ICAP to this question. Interestingly, only 5 out of 13 Australian companies selected risk appetite for this question. And maybe that's a missed opportunity for the remaining 8 companies that could at the very least be using stress and scenario or reverse stress testing in setting and setting and testing risk limits. There's also 4 Australian companies that aren't using stress and scenario testing in setting buffer capital. We found these results a little bit surprising given the expectations that APRA set and guidance in CPG 110 that states that APRA expects insurers to use stress and scenario testing to test risk appetite, to assess the appropriateness of buffer capital, and then ultimately in with the interaction with supervisory adjustments. So what would be the key messages from this slide? For a company that's on the right-hand side who wants to shimmy over to the left, firstly, that would be use stress and scenario testing above and beyond just beyond meeting regulatory requirements. The second would be clear in your purpose for why you're using stress and scenario testing. In particular, incorporate that into testing your risk appetite and setting buffer capital. So now moving on to our next question. What metrics are considered when assessing the impact of stress and scenario testing? The results here are fairly similar between the two groups. The key metrics are reported profit, solvency buffers, and regulatory capital. Where perhaps there is a difference is companies that fall into the highly valuable group are also considering economic or internal capital more than the companies in the less valuable group. In this group, there seems to be a bit more focus on balance sheet. And maybe this is indicative of where the board or C-suites of focus is placed. Some of you may wonder, well, is this just the Canadian companies that are driving this? Of the 8 companies that selected economic or internal capital for this question, 4 of those are Australian and 4 are Canadian. So what's our take-home message here? Probably just keep doing what you're doing, in that if you are focused on reported profit, if you are considering reported profit, solvency buffers and regulatory capital, if you are one of the companies that's looking at balance sheet impacts and perhaps not internal or economic capital impacts, maybe think about that decision and consider whether you could be deriving more value from focusing on other aspects. Okay, so now I'm going to hand over to Gerard, who's going to talk to you about how stress and scenario tests are developed. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Georgina. So following on from the purpose of doing stress and scenario testing, the next thing we delved into a little bit is how do companies actually develop the stress and scenario tests. Again, we follow the same theme, looking at the two groups of companies, those whose boards find it highly valuable or fundamental on the left, and those who find it less so on the right. Some very interesting results come out of this. The first is that in companies where the board finds it highly valuable, the technical areas play a critical role, and they do so in the other group as well. So in both the highly valuable and the less valuable, as you'd expect, actuarial risk management play a critical role in the development of the stresses and scenarios. What you see, though, in those companies that find it highly valuable is that the board, C-suite, and actually the executive committee, so those just below the C-suite, are involved in the development of the stress and scenario test. So on the graph there, a lot of companies put into the other category explicit comments that the board was involved right from the start. So it seems to be that involvement in the process by the top levels does have an impact on whether they find it valuable or not, or less so. The other element linking to what Georgina said earlier, some companies did respond that regulation was a key driver in what they did to do the tests, more so in the right-hand group or less valuable than the left. We delved a little bit into wider teams. So apart from the risk management and actuarial teams, what about the non-technical teams? So that could be people like operations, it could be sales and marketing, it could be even claims and underwriting, it could be administration. So amongst the wider team, what roles did they play in developing the stress and scenario testing? Another interesting insight that comes out of this is those companies who found it highly valuable involve those non-technical areas right from the start. So that's in the identification of what scenarios they should do in the first place. Then they also use them in the impact assessment for moving down the graph in some of the later processes, so assessing the impact or doing a high-level review of it. You see, with those companies finding it less valuable, that the non-technical teams tend to come on board a bit later. So that's in when you've identified the scenarios you want to do, they help you identify what outcomes could result from that. Not quite as involved in identifying the scenarios themselves. We then looked at the techniques that companies are using to develop their stresses and scenarios. So we threw out a range of techniques for companies to think about, ranging from brainstorming internally, individual interviews of people internally, perhaps looking externally as well, consulting people like medical experts outside the company, or again looking at whether the regulator is prescribing certain approaches or suggested scenarios, particularly where the regulator conducts industry-wide tests. As we probably expect, brainstorming and the use of the actuarial modelling and judgment were key components of the techniques that are used in both the highly valuable and in both the less valuable categories of companies. We did find that on those who found companies finding it highly valuable, that there was a greater emphasis on in-house interviews. So it's one-on-one interviews with various stakeholders around the company to get an idea of what stresses and scenario you should perform and the outcomes from that. Less so with the less valuable companies. Some of the companies put into the other category, which is on the bottom of the chart, things like benchmarking studies published by consultants or published articles by experts in various fields, particularly around the pandemic side of things, looking at, you know, medical articles published and comparisons between epidemics in various years. This was a very interesting slide, and I puzzled over this for quite a long while. We were interested in the effort companies are making, and what we found is that there's no appreciable difference between companies who are getting a lot of value out of stress and scenario testing at the board level and those that were less so. They pretty much spend the same time on it. So we asked the question, well, if we did this survey a year or two ago, would this slide have looked different? So what we actually did in the background is called up a couple of companies to understand this a little bit better. And what we discovered is that a year or two ago, a number of companies falling into the highly valuable category made some investments on the modelling itself, particularly around the time when APRA asked for the industry-wide stress test. wasn't a huge investment. You know, it ranged, but roughly, you know, one or two people for a few months working on refining the modeling. Can you change parameters easily? Can you do stress tests over a number of years, et cetera, and made that effort so that a year or two later, they're spending a similar amount of time to other companies, but they're just doing it in a better way so that the board gets a bit more value from it. We then looked a little bit at reverse stress testing. Some very interesting insights coming out of our questioning here. And there's a big difference between, and you see that in the table there on the left, companies who find it highly valuable tend to actually do a lot of reverse stress testing. Almost all of them, 14 out of the 15 companies, do the test. Those that found it less valuable, about 80% of them do it, 11 out of the 14. The other interesting insight is that those who find it highly valuable actually do less reverse stress tests than the companies that find it less valuable. Though what they tend to do in the highly valuable area, they do less, but they're more sophisticated. They're more scenario-based rather than single-parameter changes. Again here, following on what Regina said earlier, there's probably a lost opportunity in some of the notes that people mentioned is they use the reverse stress testing to set limits around the amount of risk they're willing to take in various areas. So we dug a little bit deeper into the reverse stress testing and looking at the allowance for management actions, whether that's allowed, and found that about half of the highly valuable companies do put management actions into the reverse stress testing, whereas a much lower proportion of those who found it less valuable do so. As I mentioned earlier, the approach to development of stress tests differed. Those who found it highly valuable do it in a more scenario-based method. About 65% of the companies do that in the highly valuable bucket, whereas those who found it less valuable, about half of them, so well, over half actually, 55% of them do them as individual stresses. So there seems to be a lot more effort put into developing a scenario that will break the company and investigating after management actions, what that point is with the more highly valuable companies. So continuing that line of thinking of management actions, we thought, well, you know, what are the actual management actions the companies are doing? Do they think about different management actions if they're a highly valuable company? Or do they think about different ones if they're less valuable? And actually what you find, if you look at the types of management actions they do most often, they're very similar. So there's a whole list there on the left, things like selling business units, stopping writing business, you might restructure the corporate structure, reinsurance, etc., all the way down to dividend policy and investment strategy. So we gave them a whole lot of choices there, and the most common ones were stop writing certain lines of business that are causing the problem, repricing, or changing the dividend policy so you hold money within the company until the capital position recovers. Those are the three most common, and that was consistent between the two groups. The next area we looked at was process improvements. So in the two groups of companies, how is the process looking? What were the improvements they made in the previous year? What were the improvements they were looking to make in the coming year? So focusing on the previous year first, the biggest improvement seemed to be spread across a range, but for the group that finds the stress and scenario testing highly valuable on the left, it looked like they had improvements in terms of improving the efficiency of the modelling, so cutting run times, where on the right-hand chart it's not the case at all, or integrating into things like business planning and interacting more with risk management. So those on the left-hand side tend to be moving further down the graph in terms of where they've made improvements in the previous year. Moving forward to next year, looking at the improvements they're making there, those that find it highly valuable are looking at making further modeling sophistication improvements and also continuing this process of integration into business planning and putting further governance structures around it. Those that found it less valuable, you can see, are still further behind, I guess, in the identification and development of the scenarios themselves. So not so much in terms of integrating into business plans or wider areas of the business. So we thought a little bit, okay, so how far have companies come along this journey of stress and scenario testing, given all those findings, since 2014? So in 2014, we undertook a survey, which was slightly smaller than the one we've undertaken this year, and we really put companies along a spectrum of three categories. The first is those who are compliance-focused, performing basic analyses with not much interaction or board involvement. The second category you see on the top of the chart there is those that were starting to use stress and scenario testing to inform their target capital triggers and their risk appetite. And then furthest along in the spectrum, those who were using it to actually develop the company strategy and challenge that business strategy. When we undertook the survey, we found that companies ranged, the blue arrows illustrating it there. No one quite got to three, but they were along that spectrum. About a quarter of companies were compliance-focused. About a third of companies were halfway along the journey towards using it to inform their target capital. About a third of them were actually using it for target capital and setting their capital triggers. And a small percentage had moved beyond that and starting to think about how they can use it to inform the business strategy and challenge the strategy. That was 2014. Moving forward 3 years, the range of responses was very similar in terms of their range between one and three. No one has quite got to three yet, but companies are further along in the journey. So no respondent to the survey we could put into the bucket of being pure compliance-based. 15% of them were now between compliance and using it to set their target capital. Big movement in terms of those who had got up to two. So two-thirds of them now using it. And an increase in the number that had moved towards using it for challenging and setting their business strategy. So key message there is companies have moved further along in the journey, not quite at three yet. Where would APRA expect you to be based on the rhetoric in responses to the industry-wide surveys, the various standards, etc.? Probably somewhere between two and three. So to conclude then, for companies who'd like to get more value out of stress and scenario testing and move along the spectrum, how do they go about this? And this is based on responses and sort of free text in the survey and suggestions that companies were actually making, what they wanted to do, and also our views based on all the questions of the survey. The first is around identification and development of the scenarios. And the key points there are to actively involve the board, engage operational and non-technical teams from the beginning, and use a range of methods when coming up with scenarios, such as brainstorming, individual interviews, or use of external experts. Communication and reporting came up over and over again in the survey, and some of the key common themes there for people to improve were reducing the length of reports, presenting the results in a clear and concise way. These seem like really obvious points, but many companies made these points over and over again. Using workshop presentations to take the board and C-suite through suggested scenarios and the outcomes of them. And communicating results more broadly in the organizations, not just within the technical teams, but wider as well. The big topic of integrating into the business and embedding it, making the link to business planning, risk appetite, and recovery and resolution planning came up a few times. Using the stress and scenario testing, in particular the reverse stress testing, to see the impact of the management actions. And then linking the scenarios to the outcomes of financial reporting. So when things are not quite going as expected, could they get much worse? And following that through in terms of the scenarios you're developing and presenting. And then a very important one was training. There were comments in the survey that the board and C-suite felt very distant from it. And so involving them in training does tend to increase the value to them. Gives them a better understanding of what they're looking at and the questions to be asking. And also training of the non-technical teams. So thank you very much for your attention, everyone. If there are any questions and comments, we can take those now. I'll hand over to Brylan to...
Thank you, Gerard and Georgina. Just a reminder that the session is being recorded, so if you have a question, if you wouldn't mind making your way to the microphone there in the room and speaking your name.
Hi there. I've got no interest in the surveys per se. I'm not in the industry. But it's just on one of your first slides, we had one of the actuarial departments said they had no interest in doing the stress and scenario testing. Did you go back and check whether that was some data error?
Stress and scenario testing? That one? We haven't followed that up with that client.
But an interesting observation. Mm.
But what we can see I'll try and flick back so people can. What we can see for that client is that the board does view stress and scenario testing as highly valuable, and the C-suite and risk management teams view it as valuable. So I'm not. It's a good, really good question. So thank you for raising it in terms of why. They've answered that way for the actuarial department. I can't provide any further insight on that. If you're here today, please let us know.
Yeah. I guess it could be that it's a department of a constrained company where the actuaries are struggling to fit it in with all the other priorities that they're doing. And so the respondent put it as red. Whereas people up the chain are actually getting a lot of value of it to push them to do that in addition to all the other priorities. That's my suspicion, but we'll look into it a bit further.
Hi, I'm Greg Solomon. I'm with Willis Towers Watson and the Reinsurance Broking Division. I spend a fair amount of time talking to companies about stress testing and trying to see what they should be doing about the stress test. I think one of the big problems is companies don't actually know, the individuals in companies don't know what to do with the stress testing results. They get the results and then they shrug and they're not sure what to do with it. With target surplus, if you do a 1 in 25 stress to your capital, you can see, your capital can take a 20% hit. Therefore, you need your target surplus at a certain level so you never fall below that target surplus. But I ask companies, like, here are the results, what are you going to do about it? They might have two products that they want to launch, and they've got the same expected return on capital, but one has got a worse stress test return on capital than the other. And I say to them, well, what are you going to do about it, or is it even a problem? And, you know, they stare at the results. They're not really sure how to interpret the fact that the stress is worse in one than the other. Is it too bad? And one of the reasons they don't know, I think, the risk appetite statements, okay, they exist in Australia, but they don't exist everywhere. Risk appetite statements are sometimes not granular enough to let them know this stress test is too bad. So I think it would be very valuable for the industry for them to get more guidance, almost case study, like here's a company, here's the stress test, this is how you interpret it, because the people I speak to just are not sure what to do with the results.
Yeah, I think that came across in where people are on the journey. The company you mentioning there, saying, look, I've got two products, same return on capital, which one should I write? And using stress and scenario testing. Doing that is actually moving along towards three in the earlier chart I have, which is the one strategically we should actually be writing. What inputs do we have to make that decision? Look at the stress and scenario testing under whatever risks you've chosen, and then helping the decision making on that. So that's a good point. Thanks.
Some of the companies that we spoke to, they were sort of moving along that journey in the sense of it seemed to us that first you needed to have the functionality, and if you haven't made the investment into the functionality, then it's very hard to get the value because just the level of modelling that you need to do and the flexibility of the modelling, it's not there to enable you to use it on that day-to-day basis. So once you've made the investment in the functionality, you've then got the problem of, well, exactly how do I use it? And the companies that we spoke to that were on that journey made the investment. They were saying that, you know, for a while they just had the functionality and they didn't know what to do with it, and then they've started using it, and the more they use it, the more their board and C-suite like it, and the more things they think to do with it, that, you know, they're getting there, but it is definitely a journey.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. My name's Kevin. Just got two quick questions. The first one's regarding, I think it was the second last slide where you showed through the different journeys. Yep, this one here.
Yep.
Then you're saying comparing the 2017 with the 2014 results, more companies are using stress testing to inform their business strategies, so integrating with their business plan. But I think in one of the earlier slides where the survey asked the companies, why are you using scenario analysis? There was a category called strategy and business planning, and if I recall correctly, only one or two companies actually chose that category.
Yeah, so the question, yes, yeah, so you're right,
So I guess my question was, it seems a bit disconnected between the two survey results.
Yeah, so in the earlier slide, which is how's it used in decision making, two companies from each category said they used it in the business planning process.
Yeah.
So that's about, in terms of all the respondents, about 25%, isn't it?
So what we have to bear in mind is the 2017 survey didn't map. We didn't ask these companies to rate themselves in these three areas as
yep.
we did in 2014. So we've tried to fit the results based on with a level of interpretation. So for those 23 companies, which is three Australian companies,
mm-hmm.
They're using stress testing in business planning and strategy. There's also another two companies who are looking into this next year, so that's where they come from.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. So I think that it still does fit with those results, but mm-hmm. I guess one thing to bear in mind is
it's not perfect.
We've mapped it as best that we can.
Okay.
So we've just got an idea of how things have evolved over the last 3 years, and we are talking about three companies there, three Australian companies. But it's a really, really good question, and thank you for paying such attention to our presentation. I'm really thrilled.
The interesting for me about looking at those two graphs is that when I did the survey in 2014, a lot of companies would have said that they were perfectly happy with where they are, including the ones who said they were basically doing it for compliance reasons. And when we look at it now in 2017, we didn't actually specifically ask the question around, are you happy with where you are now? But when you look at what companies are planning on doing, no one's really planning very much that's revolutionary, in terms of what they plan on doing, it's not too different to what they said before, which is also indicative that no one's particularly planning on investing here. However, what we can see from the regulator is that the regulator is planning on us doing stuff. The regulator wants us to move further to the right. And once the regulator sort of forces you to move further to the right, people are then starting to, go, well, I've had to build it for regulatory purposes and now I can find the use for it internally, whereas it isn't initially instinctive as to what the use for it is internally. So it's very interesting to me that some of these things, you don't quite know how to use it and you don't necessarily know what the value is because you've never seen it. And so, although, I'm not at all a fan of the regulator forcing the industry to do things, I don't think it's necessarily the right thing to do. I can, in this case, see that, having built the functionality, those companies are then getting a lot of value from it.
Yeah. Can I just ask one more quick question, if it's all right? One of your slides talks about the management actions that entities may take when they do the stress testing and scenario analysis. I've sort of reviewed, a couple of the ICAAP reports and ICAAP summary statements for different life entities, and I find those reports, they simply say at a pretty high level, such as in a stress scenario, we may reprice, we may seek reinsurance, we may get capital support. I think it was only in a few rare cases where the company actually talks about the likely effectiveness of those management actions, how long it may take to implement those actions, and any potential obstacles they may incur. I'm just wondering, in your survey, did you actually have a look at that aspect as well? Because I'm aware if I sort of just look at the ICAAP report and ICAAP summary statement, it's only, high-level documents. I'm just wondering, for your survey, do you have any insight on that?
So I think what we were asking companies is what were they actually doing in the stress and scenario test, which differs a little bit from what's the ICAAP. So the ICAAP is giving people a range of options, and this is saying, well, when you were actually doing it, which options did you use? And I think that's what the purpose of the stress testing really is to identify, well, which options work, and are you putting those options in at the relevant level to actually get the value from it? So I think you're asking exactly the right question. It's just that we're looking at it in the practical sense, not the theoretical sense of the ICAAP summary statement.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, everybody. If everyone could fill in their surveys, very much appreciated, and thank you very much. Could you please join with me in thanking Georgina and Gerard?